So I'm looking at myself. Maybe I'll just adjust my camera just a little bit. No, that didn't help, but. So this talk is about how practice meets our life. You know how these practice brushes up against our life, or life brushes up against practice, or maybe even the distinction between practice and life goes away. But there's a way in which we can practice with a lot of drivenness, a lot of striving, and a lot of like, what exactly are those instructions? And what precisely does that mean? And am I doing it exactly like the instructions suggest? There's a way that there can be, my shoulders are going up a little bit, so there can be a way in which that can be done with a lot of tension, but also there can be with a certain amount of ease. A way in which we are really trying to be precise and follow the directions, whether those directions are from a teacher or that we've read in the suttas. There can also be a way of practice which is more of a softening or feeling our way into. Maybe one way we might understand it is more with the heart leading, as opposed to the head leading, always asking the question, am I doing it right? Precisely what should I be doing? Instead, maybe the heart feeling into the experience and feeling into the space and the texture of the moment, maybe. And both of these are great ways of practices. There might be ways or times in our practice in which there is a more of a specificity, maybe, and more times when there's a little bit less specificity, maybe more diffuse sense of the directions that we're following or the way that we're using our awareness, way that we're using our attention. And in some ways we see these two differences even in the way that the teachings are. Certainly there are precise lists, four of this, five of that, eight of these other things. It's always given in a particular order, and it's a certain way in which the teachings may be kind of organized and systematized and delineated. But there also are, in these same texts, a lot of verse, a lot of poetry, which aren't, you know, numbered lists and aren't ways that are perfectly delineated. And these verse, that form of poly that they use, just like we would in English, there are maybe there's different obscure words that are only used in poetry, or poetic license, quote unquote, in the way things are expressed. Maybe there's some, and I'll say also there's a certain rhythm that the poly has for all these verses, which is a different way to understand the teachings. Sometimes, the verses when the Buddha is speaking. So sometimes these are called like inspired utterances, that after he gives a talk, at the end there'll be like a capping verse, okay? Or sometimes the verses are when people have awakening experiences. They will explain or have an inspired utterance about their awakening. So different ways of practice. And something that I'm inspired by is in the suttas, the Buddha, it's attributed to the Buddha, the way he describes his mind before awakening as being malleable. That is, not brittle, not stuck on that it can only be one way, but flexible and adaptable. So in that way, we can cultivate or experience these two different ways of practicing with maybe some specificity and precision, and maybe with some more kind of diffuse feeling our way in. Maybe it's a combination of these. So I'd like to share a poem that was written by Jane Hirschfield, who is a poet who for some time practiced at the San Francisco Zen Center, and I believe she lived at Tosahara. She's written a lot of poems and so a dedicated Zen practitioner, and she's also a translator, not of Pali, I believe of Japanese. And the way that she writes about practice, so it's a very short poem. It's called Tree by Jane Hirschfield. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose that great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already, the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. In ancient India, for the Buddha, the Bodhi tree was considered majestic and with dignity and magnificence. In California, here in the Bay Area and elsewhere, redwood trees have this majestic quality of them. They have this, for those of you who have been near them know this, there's a real calmness or something magnificent about how seemingly perfectly straight they just go up and up and up. And the way redwood trees propagate is the young trees move out from the parent tree. And one parent tree may have lots of young trees. And the young ones end up being in a circle around the parent. And then over time, the parent dies. And you're left with these beautiful, almost perfect circles of these magnificent trees with a spot in the middle. Feels like a cathedral. It's a little bit awe-inspiring. So Jane Hirschfield writes, it's foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Maybe we could understand a redwood tree as this sense of majesty, a sense of the sacred, and can represent our practice. It's the nature of trees to grow and to start with just a seed. Often we talk about this, we're just planting seeds with our practice. And then a house. The Buddha often uses the house as a metaphor for those things that we are attached to, or where it's difficult to practice. those of you who are familiar with the life story of the Buddha, you know, he like leaves his home in order to practice. We don't have to take it literally that that being in a house is somehow problematic, but it's the house is represents the things that we cling to bolster up, to protect a sense of self we might have. The things that we collect and maybe hide behind or stand on to make ourselves look different somehow. Or maybe a feeling that, okay, if I have a house in this neighborhood, then it'll mean something or it won't mean something. Or so we can understand house in terms of both our attachments as well as the way that we build up a sense of self and protect a sense of self in a way that's perhaps not helpful. The poem says, even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. For those of you who have been to IMC, you know that there's a redwood tree in front. It's probably maybe 8 feet in diameter. It's really big. And can you imagine if this tree had been planted closer to the meditation center or if one closer to a house and then just 8 feet in diameter. And at IMC, the roots of the tree, what we can't see, were so powerful that it was causing the sidewalk to buckle and making it a hazard that people might trip. So we called in the city to help us, you know, repair the sidewalk. And in my mind, I thought that they might shave the top of the roots of the tree and just put the sidewalk back in. But they rerouted the sidewalk. They moved it, you know, like 4 feet away. They moved it around, just recognizing the power of redwood trees to dismantle this concrete with no respect of the barriers or the boundaries that we have around here's where the sidewalk is supposed to be. So in the same way, practice can disrupt our attachments, those things that we're clinging to, that we're grasping. And perhaps just like a tree just grows a little bit, maybe imperceptibly. Before you know it, it's 8 feet in diameter and disrupting the sidewalk. For me, very, very early in my practice, when I still felt like meditation was just so difficult, honestly, I thought that I would start with some of the precepts. I felt like it's something that I could really do, and I took on the practice of not lying. I had noticed how much I was telling little white lies a lot. Saying things like, oh, I'm sorry I'm late, the traffic was bad. But the traffic wasn't bad, I just left late because I wasn't organized. Or getting off the phone, I would say things like, oh, sorry, I have a meeting or another call that I have to go now. But I was just had run out of telephone talking energy. And instead, I was saying these little white lies, you know, which seemed innocent enough. I thought, what would it be like to take on this practice of not telling any lies to the best of my ability? And what I discovered is, if I didn't want to tell any white lies, then I had to live my life a little differently. I had to start leaving on time, for example, so I didn't have to make an excuse why I was late. I had to speak a little bit more honestly when I was on the phone. I had to notice that some of the things that I was saying maybe didn't need to be said. And then this little, maybe it started as little, but then as I started to behave a little bit differently in order to accommodate not lying, that sense of integrity just started to have a little bit of sense of confidence as my behavior was changing. And then this confidence showed up in all kinds of different ways, including meditation practice. It's just a small sample example of how practice, we start maybe with one thing and then it grows. And then we let go of things. We start to see that, oh, you know, this actually isn't leading me towards greater and greater freedom. This thing that I'm holding on to, this grudge I'm holding on to, this resentment I'm holding on to. Because practice helps us to see more clearly those ways in which we are behaving or thinking or speaking or whatever it might be. Those ways that don't lead to greater freedom, that just reinforce all the clinging and grasping and stickiness or glue adhesiveness we might have to our experiences, to our ideas, our views. So practice helps us to see those more clearly, but it also gives us the wherewithal, gives us the confidence, gives us the know-how maybe of how to let go, how to soften, how to release those things that we are grasping, clinging. So maybe it's not so much that we have to wait until the tree grows so much and the house starts to be compromised. But we can just thoughtfully, maybe in some kind of way, like the municipal works of Redwood City, just said, you know, we're going to move this sidewalk around this way. Is there a way that maybe step by step, like, okay, well, maybe I'm going to move this here. I'm going to let go of these, what I can let go of and what it's clear. And then maybe we move things and then maybe the tree continues to grow and grow. And maybe we move the sidewalk again, or maybe we decide that we don't need a sidewalk there. We don't need a house that's supporting a sense of self or a particular sense of self. So Jane Hirschfield says that we'll have to choose that great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. I'm imagining, I don't know Jane Hirschfield, I'm imagining she's a poet. Maybe she has a lot of books. Maybe she likes to cook. She has soup pots. But we're not being asked to let go of the exact objects. We're being asked to let go of our identification with the objects or our clinging to them, our attachment to them. Maybe our hiding behind them, whatever it might be. I love this word clutter of soup pots and books, especially in contrast to calm. Clutter is often things that are neglected, you know, haphazardly kind of, you know, put to the side. maybe not looked at. Maybe we don't see it anymore, that clutter. We have to choose between that calm being and this clutter of soup pots and books. Clutter, maybe we start to see it with practice. We start to see how it's the opposite of calm when it's compared to the calm of the beautiful tree that has this majesty about it. And so it's not asking us to let go of the actual objects, but our relationship to the object, perhaps like our compulsion to really make them ours or make them mean something in particular, or the way that we grab onto them or snatch them maybe or something. And this way to soften and let go of the ways that we limit ourselves, the way that we limit and the way that we define ourselves is also a way of limiting ourselves. So there's a verse that's in the Dhammapada, attributed to the Buddha. And he talks that says about after his awakening, to have said something like this. This is what the tradition holds. Goes like this. House builder, you are seen. You will not build a house again. All the rafters are broken, the ridgepole destroyed. The mind, gone to the unconstructed, has reached the end of craving. So practice meeting our life and our attachments doesn't have to be violent. It doesn't have to be brutal the way that maybe this verse suggests. But is there a way that to just let go of what we can let go of? To notice where there is clinging and where there is maybe some grasping. And then this poem continues by saying, already the first branch tips brush at the window. I would say, attending a meditation retreat while in your living room or wherever you are in your house is a way in which the branch tips of practice are brushing at the window. It's your life, the way that you live your life, where you live your life. And of course, the branch tips are what's visible above the ground. But of course, redwood trees with their roots disrupt sidewalks and get into sewage systems and break the pipes. Lots of different ways, maybe some of them obvious and above ground and some of them not so obvious and below ground, so to speak. But with the branch tips at the window points also to a meeting of our sense of self and our practice. And of course, it's not always comfortable or easy. And what comes to mind for me is in the story of the Buddha, how before his awakening, how he meets Mara. Mara is a character in the Buddhist literature that can be interpreted in a number of ways. Can say it's the aspect of the heart or the mind that creates roadblocks or creates excuses or procrastinates or urges us to avoid everything that's unpleasant or urges us to maybe just stay with the familiar or what we know with or just grab tighter to those things. In some ways, we might say that Mara is the inner experience of greed, hatred, and delusion, the roots of that are keeping us from freedom, the roots of the hindrances, the roots of the defilements, the roots of those things that get in the way of practice. And sometimes Mara attacks with some vengeance. Again, with the story of the Buddha, that Mara brings a big giant army to attack the Buddha, demanding to know, like, the Buddha, who do you think you are that you can become awakened? Maybe trying to plant some doubt in the mind of the Buddha, but the Buddha always meets Mara with some loving, kind awareness and disarming Mara with the kind of this wise response. The Buddha says, I see you, Mara. And then Mara skulks away. So in some ways, you know, the meaning of practice in our lives is not always straightforward, not always easy. But in some kind of way, we can learn to meet it with some openness of heart, some wisdom, as best we can. Practice isn't asking us to be anybody other than who we are. We get to be exactly how we are. And we're just creating the conditions in which practice can grow naturally. And it'll be expressed in us in different ways. And we'll experience some of the difficulties in different ways. But we can live a life of responding wisely to the inner Maras, inner difficulties, as well as to those that we see on the experience externally. It might reflect a moment on what ways practice has touched your life, and what ways are the branch tips brushing against the window? And then this last line of the poem, softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. Immensity, vastness, hugeness, bigness, boundlessness, no limits. Without a sense of how things should be, that's the limit. Without a sense of, I'm this way, I can do this, I can't do that. Instead, immensity, rather than just brushing against the window, is now like tapping, a little bit more insistent. In this poem, Jane Hirschfeld writes, you have to choose that calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. But maybe as practice grows, it switches. You have to choose this calm being, that is, those spaces that we've touched into, we recognize that are wholesome, that are supportive, that are peace and freedom, those tastes or of freedom, those maybe even just the scent of freedom. We might have to choose this calm being, that clutter, maybe having touched into some of the immensity of what's possible. Notice that, oh, do I really want to pick that up? Do I want to pick up that grudge that I have? Do I want to pick up that idea that I have to behave a particular way, show up a particular way in order for people to care about me, in order for me to care about myself? It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. Is there a way that we can practice with the poetry of the moment, as Max said? Part of the beauty of poetry is that the poet, in order to kind of condense a lot of meaning into a few words, has really had to have some sharpness, some acuity, some real mindfulness about what they're trying to express, to really experience it, so that then it can be expressed in a way that's often using metaphor, in the case here, but it also is evocative, or provocative, or maybe paints a picture. So different than providing a list or precise instructions, kind of with this poetic sensibility or sensitivity to poetry, or poetry of the moment, poetry of what's being pointed to, what's being asked for. Can we have that be part of our practice? With this openness of heart, openness of mind, as best we can. Sometimes we're busy wrestling with Mara. Sometimes Mara has the upper hand, and we don't see the poetry in the moment. Sometimes we tap into that immensity, the beauty, grace, the vastness, awakening, freedom. That's available for us just by planting the seeds. Just planting the seeds and helping to create the conditions in which those seeds might grow. I think I'll stop there. And maybe we'll just sit for a minute or two before I go on to the next thing. So now I'd like to turn this over to Max, who will start with addressing some of the questions that were submitted in the Q&A on the document.
Okay, thank you very much, Diana. So we thought in this retreat, after the talk, we'll just we'll take a look at the questions that have come in and offer some responses. As one of my teachers Mel Weitzman would often say, I can't promise that I'll answer your question, but I'll respond. Okay, so here's the question. I've noticed that short lines from songs tend to replay in my head over and over, and it seems to be a subtle way of resisting my direct experience. Like if I'm experiencing some boredom, for example, I've tried being nonchalant about it, bringing my awareness to it, using it as a signal that my mind has wandered and coming back to body, breath, etc. But I'm wondering what you would say is the most skillful response. So I appreciate this question, and I think it's probably an experience that we can all relate to, this idea of, you know, some repetitive music or thought or something that's playing over and over again. And so I'll offer a short answer and then a medium answer. And the short answer is a little bit of a technique that was shared with me a while ago that I find very helpful, especially if there's a kind of song or music that's, or so, you know, something that's running, feels like it's running through the mind. And this has happened for me more in the last few years because my children, they study the cello in the Suzuki method. And those of you who know the Suzuki method, it's that you learn by ear. And the way you learn by ear is by listening to the music over and over and over again. So I've listened to Suzuki Book One, I mean, I don't know, maybe 2,000 times or something. You know, how many days are there? So this little tip, this technique is basically, if you're hearing the music in your mind, and you notice that you're hearing it, I mean, you know, it's not a problem to hear music in your mind, right? But if you're noticing it and you want it to stop, then what I find works very well is simply opening to listening. So it's like shifting to open, to listen to the sounds, you know, the sounds in the room, the silence, the sound of the birds, you know, this hum of the refrigerator, whatever sounds are present. For me, I find that I can't, you know, it's like the same part of the mind that hears that internal music is the part that listens to sounds. So anyway, you can play with that. And, I love little hacks like that. So that's kind of the short answer. And then I think this is a great question because it brings up the kind of fundamental issue of practice in how do we relate to mental activity? How do we relate to our thinking, our ideation, our conceptual mind, the kind of repetitive thinking, or, you know, just the stuff that our cognitive mind does? And I think one way of understanding meditation is that the goal of meditation is to empty our mind out. You know, if I can just get all this chatter to quiet down, then I'll be calm and present and, concentrated and peaceful. And that's possible, you know, but it's, I think what most of us discover is that it is, if that's the goal, if we set that up to be the goal of our practice, then we'll have moments, occasional moments of this kind of emptiness, right? This kind of stillness, and lots of moments of struggling with our mind, and lots of moments of feeling like, oh God, my mind is not doing what I want it to do. And it's like this, and I want it to be like that, right? And that state of inner conflict, inner division is called dukkha, right? It's called suffering. So rather than trying to empty out the contents of our mind and kind of silence the music, silence, you know, the chatter. Another way of understanding practice or relating to this is that we're our intention is to make peace, to come to peace with the contents of our mind. So what is it to be so soft, so open, so spacious that, yeah, that music is playing, but it's not playing in this little tiny contracted, you know, mind. It's playing in the, you know, this vast universe. And it's this little drop in this vastness, you know. And when we have this feeling that we're not struggling with how the mind is, it's interesting. So in my experience, things tend to settle on their own. You know, it's one of the examples we sometimes use is like a cloudy glass of water. And you know, the way to clear up the water is just to leave it alone. And it's hard to do. It's hard to do. It's hard to leave ourselves alone. But maybe we could, if we substitute the word mind for the word life, do we want to empty the contents of our life? You know, that doesn't sound so much fun. If we empty out my life of all activity, all people, all things, all joy, all suffering, all problems, then I'll finally be happy. Do we want to empty out our life, or do we want to come to peace with the contents of our life? You know? And so, as Diana was so beautifully saying, what is it to not have this division between our practice and our life? And I think the time that we sit in practice is like a just peace or intensified peace of our life, that we're learning how to live through this sitting. So maybe, yeah, I don't know, Diana, if you want to add to that.
No, I don't have anything to add. That was very nice, Max. Maybe I'll address one more question. The question was, can you say more about what radical means? For example, Max used the phrases radical permission and radical acceptance. I don't know exactly what Max meant, but maybe he'll have something to say about what I have to say. But these ideas of radical permission and radical acceptance is, you know, and is like non-ordinary. It's like beyond what's the usual, or more than what we might assume. When we use this word permission, we might think that there's some permission, but radical permission asks us to really check, is that complete permission? Is it as full, as complete as it can be? Or is it the usual permission? So the same with acceptance. So I think what Max is pointing to here is that maybe beyond the usual is kind of more fully. And maybe I'll just add onto there that sometimes I talk about practice as having some radical contentment. You know, sometimes we feel like contentment's a nice thing to have, but like this complete, thorough contentment, like, yes, it's okay. So maybe beyond the ordinary. Or, I don't know, Max, do you have something you'd like to say to that?
Oh, that sounds good to me. I mean, somehow I have the idea that the etymology of the word radical has to do with the root, going to the root of something. And so, yeah, somehow that also feels connected to, radical permission is like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I like what you said. It's very nice. Yeah.
You know, maybe that I'll riff a little bit on what you said about the etymology being about root. You know, but root can also be a verb. So in some ways, radical permission is a little bit like to root out where there isn't permission. You know, to see some of the hidden ways or something like that in which there isn't permission. So, of course, there's roots of redwood trees that grow next to houses also. Roots. Maybe we'll end with that.
Maybe we'll just remind folks that tonight and tomorrow night, at the end of the last sitting, which is, I think, from 7:30 to 8:15, at 8:15, we'll say a few words. So that's what the evening reflection means.
Great. Thank you for your practice. See you in a few hours.